Cambridge 105. We love being local. You bet your FM life.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour with Ruth Reyes and me, Alan Alder. No Matt Bentman today, but he will be back next time.
On today's programme, we celebrate the bank holiday with two, yes, two, new cocktails from Aoife Maxwell. One is pretty potent, so she kindly provides the second as an antidote.
Nazima Pathan will be reviewing some food blogs for us, including one that specialises in desserts made from vegetables. Anything you've ever had, Ruth?
I've had a chocolate and beetroot cake once.
Oh, that sounds okay. Right.
<It's> all right.
Good. Well, anyway, it's one of several pretty interesting blogs that Nazima recommends, so you might like to have a piece of paper handy to note down the details of those you like the sound of.
I've been chatting with Go-Go Goji Gooey, who do Korean barbecue food at Food Park in Station Road on Thursdays.
Also on today's programme, Gigi Perry reviews student cookery books.
We've a simple recipe for the novice cook to try from Ely-based baker Lucy.
And we've been finding out what summer snacks people in Cambridge have been enjoying. Oh, and we'll also be hearing from Tom Lewis about understanding wine through music.
But let's begin with students going away to uni and having to cook for themselves for the first time. Although we're in bank holiday mode today, university terms do start soon. So Gigi Perry has been delving into student cookbooks and has some recommendations.
Gigi, you've been reviewing student cookbooks for us.
I have.
Right. What sort of things were you looking for?
The thing I think with student cooking is you're low on time, often low on budget, and it's the end of a tiring day. So what you want when you're looking for something to cook, you want something that looks fun and exciting and it's appealing. And then within that, really, it depends on what skills you've got as a cook, and then you can sort of go from there.
Okay. Well, let's imagine the student who is going to go to university for the first time this year, and who knows nothing about cooking. Is there a book that can help them? Has a book been written for them?
There has. I think one of the best books I've come across is The Hungry Student Cookbook by Charlotte Pike, who was a student at St Andrews and had to survive on £10 a week. Her recipe book, she has three of them, but the main cooking book one is fantastic, and I think if you're wanting a cookbook that you can last you from freshers to graduation, it really is hers. It's brilliant food on a budget, and it has showstoppers as well as everyday meals. So you've got the showstopper-wise, she does a sort of tequila chocolate sauce with ice cream and a vodka pasta, which is all exciting, but as well as things like spaghetti bolognese, tomato and garlic spaghetti, stir fries, salads. It's very easy to follow, and you really could be, if you're looking for inspiration as an experienced cook, it's brilliant. But also, if you've never cooked before, it's a really good one.
And with the exception of the tequila, it sounds like it's cheap ingredients.
It is, and healthy. And she gives you advice on where to buy things from, how to store it, what to do with leftovers. And it's just a very nice book to flick through as well.
Right.
So it's a good one.
Okay, tell us what it's called again.
That is The Hungry Student Cookbook by Charlotte Pike, and it's £6.99. And it actually comes, she has three books. One is a vegetarian cookbook, which is brilliant, even for meat eaters, but it's as well as a baking one, and her sort of general cookbook.
Right, sorry, so there's a general cookbook, a vegetarian one.
And a baking one,
And a baking one. And they're all good.
They're all fantastic. What's really good about it is the ingredients are sort of they are everyday ingredients, so you're not going to be going out buying millions of spices and herbs. Mm. It's things that you would have in the store cupboard.
Because that is expensive, isn't it? You have to go out and buy fenugreek seeds and this and the other
lime.
Seeds. Kaffir lime. Right. Okay. Did you find any others?
I did. So if you're someone who needs to be coaxed into the kitchen...
So this is the reluctant cook.
The reluctant cook, right. But the greedy cook.
Right.
Tiffany Goodall's From Pasta to Pancakes, the ultimate student cookbook, is really brilliant because she has photographs of every step of the way. So it's really good if you don't really know how to simmer something or if you're not sure on how to chop up the vegetables. And so that, from that point of view, it's a brilliant book. They're brilliant for limited cash and equipment. She has different chapters on sort of her hangover breakfast, And it covers everything. So it's got the sort of fry up, but also it's got the healthy breakfast, so smoothies and things like that. And she has a section on entertaining friends, on drinks. And she also actually has an app with it that you can get on iTunes. So it's a really good one for learning different ways.
Yeah. The idea of having a sequence of photographs showing you what things should look like or how to do things is actually, it sort of settles you, doesn't it, really?
It does. And it's really useful because it's when you're used to cooking, it's really easy to know how to boil something. But if you're not really sure or you're not sure if you've cooked enough, it's perfect for someone who's not totally certain in the kitchen. But also it's actually a really good book just to be able to flick through. So
yeah. OK, tell us the name again.
That's by Tiffany Goodall, From Pasta to Pancakes, The Ultimate Student Cookbook. And she's appeared on sort of Market Kitchen and things, so you'd probably recognise her as well.
Right, next one.
Sam Stern has a student cookbook that Gordon Ramsay said you shouldn't leave the kitchen without. And it's this, I think, is a brilliant cookbook if you're not if you're in cater halls, but you sort of cook a couple of times a week, or if you want really fun, tasty food to entertain with. And I think so there's a section at the beginning of this that has different food from around the world. So he has a Mexican spread and all different like different things you can make for that, an Indian one which has onion bhajis with a mango chutney and naan and a lentil dal.
What, making your own mango chutney?
Yes, it does. And it's actually, this is why I think it's not such an everyday recipe book, because he has things like that. So it's if you're making a sort of special occasion, but it's less ingredients than an average cookbook would have. And it's the pages are completely jam-packed with information and tips and photographs. So it's a really lively book to look through. So it's, and it has hundreds of recipes in there.
Yeah, it sounds quite adventurous as well.
It is, yeah. There's various things of, it has food from all over the world to make, different flavours and things, which so it's fun food and tasty.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Okay, thank you.
It's a brilliant book.
This next one looks familiar.
This is A Girl Called Jack. The reason I think that's it's brilliant for student cookbook is she sort of notoriously survived on £10 a week. And if you flick through her, the recipes, they're really fantastic, hearty flavours. And such few ingredients you need are needed for them. And she also has loads of advice on ways to substitute, so thickening out a soup to make into a pasta sauce, how to use the leftovers.
Yeah. Does she give advice in that book? Because I know she does somewhere about shopping cheaply.
She does.
Things like looking at the bottom shelf and
her section at the beginning of the book, which says sort of the basic pans you should have and how to save money by not buying branded products, is the best out of any of the student cookbooks to look through, because it's really practical advice in a very clear and easy to understand way.
I read one of the things she said about buying ingredients. Sometimes a shop, a supermarket, will sell the same ingredient in three different parts of the shop at wildly different prices.
Yeah.
Things like walnuts, you know, you can buy walnuts as a snack for baking, for putting on cakes or somewhere, or a health food, and they'll sell them in different packaging at very different prices.
So where to look out
for? Yeah, well, that's really worthwhile, that Girl Called Jack. She's got a good reputation for cheap ingredients, and as you said, substituting cheaper ingredients for more expensive ingredients.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also her, obviously she started out on a blog as well, so you can log onto the internet and there's useful things there as well to pick up.
Yeah. Good.
Further recipes.
Okay. Any more?
I think if you're a parent looking for ways to sort of guide your children before they go to university, a really good book is by Joy May called 101 Questions Students Ask About Cooking. And it's not a book that a student would probably pick up and read, because it's the type of question that they may, if they're desperate, actually call you up to ask you about or type it into Google. But it, as a parent, it's really good. It's questions like, what can you freeze? What can you reheat? How do you know when meat is cooked? Best way of storing herbs, or the questions that everyone wants to know. So if you've got time before your children go to university, it's a really good book to have as a pointer of things that would be useful for them to know before they go. And Joy May, who wrote it, has also got a book, A Cookbook Nosh for Students, which has her recipes in there as well. And it's sort of on just cheaper cuts of meat, but tasty food. And so it is a good book for a parent to buy, I think.
Yeah, good. Tell us what it's called again.
That's 101 Questions Students Ask About Cooking by Joy May.
Well, thanks to Gigi Perry for that. Really interesting and useful review. In case you missed them, the books were The Hungry Student Cookbook by Charlotte Pike, From Pasta to Pancakes, a pretty good title, I think, by Tiffany Goodall, Student Cookbook a bit more workmanlike as the title, by Sam Stern, A Girl Called Jack by Jack Munro, and 101 Questions Students Ask About Cooking. Did you have a favourite cookbook at uni?
Not any particular cookbooks. I kind of just did it, you know, off the cuff and looked at blogs.
Well, you're still alive. We just added water. We just added water to dehydrated stuff. Hoped for the best.
Same.
105 Drive is probably the busiest show we have on Cambridge 105. People are switching on all the time. We start at 4 o'clock. We're catching the end of the school run as well as people leaving work, so the half-hourly travel comes in useful. We bring you national and local news, plus the sport and what's happening in the world of entertainment. After six, we kick back a little. On Mondays, we've got the Chart Hour. Tuesdays, the number ones. And Thursdays, film and theatre with Sky and Hattie. I really enjoy the variety of guests. One day, a community leader. The next, a magician. Politician, an actor. Actually, maybe those are the same. And the music, well, some you know, some you don't, but it's all good. 105 Drive from 4 till 7 on your way home on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Now, if as a student you're ever feeling hungry, yet lacking the will to bake something complicated and perhaps a bit low on funds, rock cakes may be the answer. Here's baker Lucy from Ely.
So rock cakes?
Yes.
What are their origins?
Well, originally basically made back in the Second World War, because what happened is they wanted something that was a cheaper product with using less eggs and less sugar, because in those days it was very expensive. And if you go back to World War II, they substituted some of the flour for oats as well, because oats were cheaper. But nowadays, if you make them, you'll make them with flour rather than oats.
Right.
But so instead of, if you made a cake, you'd use about 4 eggs, whereas you make rock cakes, you use only about one, and use milk to bind. And it's a very easy process because it's just flour or oats. If you use oats, sugar, dried fruit, eggs, milk, and you bind it all together. Oh, there is some butter in it, but very little. And then you just bind it all together.
Okay.
So it's very easy and it's nice warm with butter on. And you basically have it at tea time and it fills stomachs up so they don't eat so much for dinner later on. So it's like a food that fills people up without, so costs works out cheaper.
Okay, so walk me through it. How many, you said we need one egg.
About one egg, yeah.
About one egg.
Depends on how much you use, roughly.
Okay. How much flour? So is it just by eye or?
No, you can do a recipe out if you want to. It varies on each recipe. If you do it in grams, it's about 100 grams to about one egg to 25 grams of butter, because it hasn't got a lot of butter or marge you could use. And then fruit, you can just a handful of fruit. So, right. You know, a few ounces. Milk to bind. So it's quite simple if you're making a small amount. And then you put them on the baking sheet, basically individually in clumps. You can sprinkle the top of Demerara sugar if you want. Nowadays we can, because we can afford to.
Yeah.
Years gone by you wouldn't have. You can just put them on greaseproof paper in the oven, sprinkle Demerara sugar before you put them in, and they'll just rise up and it's all about golden brown. So about 20 to 25 minutes.
All right, so we just punk them onto the
baking sheet. Yeah, it's very simple.
It's very
children
simple.
Children can make them. They're brilliant for children. So there's not a lot involved, but they are you don't see them much nowadays. Because they're sort of an old fashioned thing. You can get them, but not very very readily. Because it's lots of variations to them as well now. Because people use all different fruits rather than just using. Years ago, you'd use mainly currants, but now you can use apricots, dried apricots, sultanas. Raisins, you can do like a mixed fruit, and some people put nuts in them now just to change them. Some people even put coconut in them. Change them rather than just being a plain rock cake to more variety, and also one of your five a day.
So this would be really good for a student with very little money.
Very good, quite cheap, very easy to produce, especially if they're not very good at cooking. And
great.
Very good for children, because you tend to go for things like your scones or your Eccles cakes and things like that. So they're a very old recipe, but very nice warm with butter.
Easy to do, easy to eat, and most importantly, cheap as chips. Actually, probably cheaper.
We made them together, and as Lucy said, even children can make them, so it's the perfect student recipe.
Well, there is an alternative to cookery books for all of us, and that's food blogs. And there are thousands of them, but which ones are any good? Well, it depends what you're looking for, of course. But here's Nazima Pathan to provide some guidance and recommendations.
The great thing about food blogs is that there is so much a variety of flavours and ingredients and inspiration, and also often a lot of detailed photography to sort of guide you step by step through recipes in the best food blogs.
And the photography is an important feature.
Well, it is, and that's what makes the successful food blogs most successful. Having said that, as you mentioned, there are thousands of blogs there. You know, you rapidly would find yourself drawn to ones that are suit what you're looking for.
But you've got to be able to find it on a blog, so they've got to be easily searchable.
If I'm looking for a recipe, I'll search by image and obviously then go to the one image that the blog that has the most attractive image.
So could you give us some examples of the blogs you've been talking about? What about some of the original and highly successful ones, or what are they?
Been around for quite a while, and some of the earliest ones were obviously American. David Leibovitz is a chef who's an American chef who lives in Paris, and he has a very nice, very well written food blog called davidleibovitz.com, and he is a pastry chef, so mainly it is sweet stuff. He talks about his travels as well and has a very nice guide to Paris. So, for example, that's a good stop.
A foodie guide to Paris?
Yes, with lots of restaurant recommendations. It's a great resource for anyone who enjoys cooking sweet stuff or is visiting Paris. He's got a lot of tips there.
Does his or anybody else's blogs include video to actually show you techniques?
Yeah, quite a few. There's and some are, you know, very successful with that. I know there's one called Fuss Free Flavors, and she does some videos. In terms of the American ones, there's Paul. One is called Steamy Kitchen, and she also does. And some of them also have headsets, you know, so that you can have dictation software, so you write as you go. So the writing and what they write is very natural. Obviously, well-written blogs are going to make a blog more successful. Yeah. Thinking about your reader, not just what you want to say. I think good bloggers have to remember it's not about them. It's about what you're making.
Okay, so you mentioned David Leibovitz as being one of the first ones and a very successful one. Any others?
A couple of other American blogs, very big. Orangette is a woman who now is in Seattle who started a food blog and subsequently got book deals as well. And Canelle Vanille, Canelle, and Vanille, French for vanilla, Canelle et Vanille. Both very nice food blogs. Canelle Vanille is, in fact, a gluten-free food blog, and she does very interesting stuff and nice pastry ideas as well.
Have you any idea how many people go to those blogs? Is it
now? I think it's, you know, they've got tens of thousands of followers on even just on Facebook, and even if you look at their blog and their content, the comments that people make, there's hundreds of comments. So particularly over in America, where people are more engaged with blogs, it is getting increasingly popular here.
What other blogs do you particularly like?
When we decided to sort of talk about this, I was thinking about what would make a blog particularly attractive in these days when there is so much choice out there. There's got to be some that stand out, and what makes them different, I suppose, is either extremely beautiful photography or something very different. So as an example of something very different, there's a website called Veggie Desserts, and very young blog, I think she's only been around for a year. She makes cakes and ice creams and lollipops from vegetables. So her latest post is cauliflower and chocolate ice lollies with pistachio dust. And if you look at the photographs and you look at the recipes, you know, they look stunning, and certainly something that you'd make. Another example of a recipe from Veggie Desserts is that she's done a lovely jam. Now, this is really interesting to me because what she's used is chia seeds. Chia seeds are a seed that swell up with water and so in sort of can help set something. And
yeah,
here,
chia,
C-H-I-A, and in fact, I bought some from the health food shop on Mill Road, so it is available. Mm-hmm. And what she's done is that she has whizzed up fruit, in this case beetroot and raspberry, with chia seeds, and it doesn't need cooking. And so then it went overnight, it will set and become a jam. You preserve the goodness.
I was going to say,
not having to cook.
The vitamins aren't going to be oxidized, are they?
So I think it's a great idea. And then she did a cinnamon ice cream with radishes that she's roasted in maple syrup as a garnish. So just interesting flavours. And the beautiful photography means that it makes you think you might want to give it a go. And then there's another lovely one called Food to Glow, Kelly's Food to Glow. Lovely lady, and writes really nicely and has some amazing global recipe ideas, largely vegetarian with some fish and white meat thrown in. She has really interesting flavours, and one of her recent recipes that I really liked was where she used these noodles that people are talking about a lot now. These are made of sweet potato noodles, and you can also get bean curd noodles, and she's made a stir fry with those and with marinated and baked tofu, and she puts in really interesting flavours. She does shakshuka, which is a Middle Eastern dish, but she's made it so that's kind of baked eggs, but instead of a very tomatoey base, which is traditionally what's done, she's done it with different vegetables and lots of greens as well, yeah, to make it healthy. Yeah, her photography's absolutely beautiful. Yeah. Some really nice recipes with, you know, spices and herbs from everywhere. And
this must take a lot of time.
Does take a lot of time because it's not just about cooking it. Obviously, it's photographing it and then editing the pictures and the images and then promoting it. But a lot of people do. You know, I work full time and yet I still do this. Yes. It's
where your interests
are. Hobby. Yes, exactly. And then another example of an interesting blog is Fuss-Free Flavours. Helen, who writes that, is again a great writer, writes really well. And she's an example of someone who, beyond just publishing, is a pro blogger, i.e. she's making an income. And like us as well, you know, we are working with brands and doing recipe development. So brands and food companies see the benefit of food bloggers in terms of the big social media presence and are keen to sort of work with bloggers, and she does that, a lot of recipe development work and working full-time on it. Not actually, it's not a hobby for a lot of people.
So brands must employ people who are seeking out bloggers.
Yes, it's definitely a very strong thing, not just with food bloggers, but in other blogging fields too. It's a form of increasing their exposure and getting mentions on other sites. Google is aware of this and has tightened up, and obviously advertising standards, you know, bloggers have a loyal audience, so you can't just put stuff on there as free advertising and not disclose it to your followers. So you need to make it clear when you've been paid for something. But for example, we often get paid for developing a recipe for brands and or get given, you know, appliances, and as a result it's a sort of exposure for them, but also an opportunity for us.
Well, that perhaps answers my next question, or partly, which is, why do people write blogs in the first place? But they're not all doing it for an income.
No. I think, I mean, even for me, it's not an income as such. It's a creative outlet, and that's the important thing, is to think of it as a creative outlet of writing down something that you love to do. And it's important to do that, because otherwise the passion doesn't come through. Mm. And the point of it is not about getting free stuff or getting exposure or being famous or getting a book deal. It's about, you know, your passion must come through first, and then people obviously can develop a career out of it, and that has happened to quite a few people.
Well, that's really good.
Well, that was really interesting. If you want to know the names of those blogs again, we'll repeat them after this. Or actually now.
Okay. Right, the first blog that Nazima mentioned was David Leibovitz. That's the one that also has a guide to Paris as well as recipes. And Leibovitz is spelled Leibovitz.
Then there was Orangette. She blogs from Seattle, and it's spelled orange with double T-E on the end.
The third blog was called Cannelle et Vanille. Her recipes are gluten-free, and there are some very nice-looking dishes there. Whether you need to avoid gluten or not, I do think most people want to try them. The spelling is Cannelle, C-A-N-E-L-L-E, A-E-T, Vanille, V-A-N-I-L-L-E.
And the Veggie Desserts blog, Food to Glow, and Fuss-Free Flavours were the other blogs.
Nazima and husband Pierre do a blog themselves too, and I think it's very good indeed. It's franglaiskitchen.com, and many congratulations to them for having recipes in The Guardian and Metro this week. Now, since it's a bank holiday Monday, well, it's not bank holiday Monday, since it's a bank holiday weekend, we're bringing you not one but two cocktails today inspired by summer in Cambridge. Here's Aoife Maxwell to talk about the first.
Right, Aoife, any particular inspiration this week?
Well, a bit of a strange inspiration this week, not really my usual, you know, fresh ingredients from the market or anything like that. So I was standing in the kitchen the other day, and a song that I used to really love popped into my head. So when I was a teenager, probably about 16, 17, a long time ago now, I was a big fan of Oasis. Seems very corny now, but their song Cigarettes and Alcohol popped into my head. And I know with lots of rock concerts and everything going on this summer, trying to think of a cocktail, you know, based around that theme, cigarettes and alcohol seemed the perfect thing. You know, how could you combine that into a cocktail? Bourbon seems to be the big cocktail that all the rock stars and pop stars are drinking these days, and it is it's a great spirit. And I think we've done some stuff with it before. We've looked at Manhattan's.
Yeah.
It's a great drink. So I thought that, you know, that would make a good start. And I do love an old fashioned or a Manhattan. You know, what could we do around that? But how to get that cigarette flavour in there? It's a big challenge. I had seen quite a few people online infusing their own spirits with pipe tobacco, cigars, that type of thing. And you know that I like to infuse my own spirits, but even I draw the line at using tobacco. And really the main reason for that is just the level of carcinogens in tobacco. While I think that you could probably get some of the flavour, I'd be worried that I wouldn't be able to quantify those carefully enough to not poison any guests that I head over. So I decided to play it safe. And actually I found this commercially available liqueur, Perique, would you say? Which is a American liqueur flavoured with a type of Louisiana tobacco, which apparently is one of the rarest and most wonderful in the world. It's quite a smooth liqueur, woody, a little bit of a herbal from the tobacco, I think. But I think it's kind of a safe way to get that cigarette flavour.
And is this easily available?
This is available quite straightforwardly on a lot of the websites that I'd use for ordering things like bitters or nice spirits. So my favourite, and I have no connection to these people, but it's a great store, is Master of Malt. So they have great service and a great range of spirits. So I'd highly recommend it.
Yeah.
I ordered some things and they came the next day, even though I hadn't paid for express delivery. So it was a bonus. So I decided to keep it quite simple, really, with this cocktail and really base it on this idea of an old-fashioned. So an old-fashioned is normally sugar, orange zest, whiskey stirred together, you know, something with some bitters. So I thought I'd keep it somewhat similar. So what we want is our bourbon. Oh, it smells great. So I'm going to use 30 mils of bourbon.
Right.
Into my cocktail shaker. Then 30 mils of this tobacco liqueur, because it's subtle enough, so I want, you know, a pretty strong hit of it if I can. So equal amounts with the bourbon. And then I'm going to use 10 mils of simple syrup. So I think we've talked about simple syrups before, so 1-to-1 sugar and water. And this one is one that I've used before as well, that I've infused with some Christmas spices. So,
well, cloves.
Cloves, cinnamon, star anise. So it's not too strong, but just that extra little bit of kind of spicy herbalness.
Yeah.
Just to, and this is one of those things, you know, I've made a big batch and I use it, you know, in different cocktails as they come up. But if you didn't have any, just simple syrup would work just as well. The other thing that I'm going to put in here is some pieces of orange zest. So I've just literally used a knife, or you could use a vegetable peeler, to peel off a bit of the orange skin, press them so that the juices in the orange skin goes into the drink. But I'm also dropping the zest into the mixture. Then I'm going to add some orange bitters, one of my favourites. Quite widely available. This is Regan's Orange Bitters number 6. This is a great bitters for old fashions, Manhattans, anything bourbon based. I'd really recommend this. And because we have the orange flavour from the zest, it goes well. So 3 or 4 little dashes. Okay, now before I shake this up with ice, I'm going to get my glass ready. So I'm just going to take an old-fashioned glass, so quite a short tumbler. So I filled that glass with about 3/4 full of ice. And then to garnish, the classic old-fashioned type garnishes. So a nice piece of orange, which I'm going to pierce to a cocktail stick. And a glass of cherry, because you can't go wrong. Okay, so back to my cocktail shaker. I'm going to add some ice in here. So I'm just going to give this a quick stir just to cool the cocktail down. Okay, now I'm just going to strain that into my prepared glass. And I've stirred it over ice, and I'm going to add it to more ice just to get it nice and cold.
Mm.
You know, you could probably just combine them and pour them straight onto the ice, but just to get that extra little bit of chillness to that ice. Now, cocktails like this, based on an old-fashioned, are always something you think somebody might be drinking in Mad Men or something like that. So, see what you think.
Yes.
It's strong, but really quite smooth. And I think that comes from the tapioca liqueur and the little bit of sugar syrup.
Yeah.
Really smooths it out.
That's a good one.
You could imagine some kind of hardcore, you know, rock star drinking that, I like to think.
Right, let's just summarise then. 30 mils of bourbon.
30 mils of bourbon. 30 mils of tobacco liqueur.
Yeah.
10 mils of simple syrup, flavoured with spices, if you should so be inspired. A couple of dashes of orange bitters. You could use Angostura if you had them and you didn't have the orange bitters. Piece of orange zest. Shake it over ice or stir it and then strain into a glass full of ice.
Right. And have you a name for it?
Cigarettes and alcohol. It had to be.
It did. Thank you very much.
And you can find Aoife's recipes on her blog, sweetpeasandsours.com. And Aoife will be back later in the programme to provide the healthy alternative to that bit of excess.
Cambridge 105.
Community radio in your city.
Difficult to say and difficult to spell on our website. Easy to eat, Korean barbecue food, street food style. A new kid on the block, Gogo Goji Gooey, only started training at Food Park 3 weeks ago. But it looks like they want to bring Korean food to the forefront.
How do you pronounce the name?
The name is pronounced Gogo Gogi Gooey.
Okay,
so
Gogi Gooey.
Yeah, so Gogi Gooey in Korean means barbecued meat. It literally means meat roasting.
Okay.
But it refers to all the meats that they barbecue on their traditional kind of barbecue sets, which you get everywhere in Korea. So there's a huge barbecue culture throughout the year in Korea, mostly indoors on this kind of gas griddle that you get in the middle of the table.
Yeah.
So Gogi Gooey refers to all of those. The Gogo is English for go and go again. And I whacked it in front of the Gogi Gooey just that people would have an indication as to how they might pronounce the rest of it.
Okay.
Don't know if it works. But, you know, once you know it's Gogi Gooey, I don't know, the go-go kind of reminds you of how to say it. So.
It makes sense now that I've asked.
Yeah. No, I've had to explain it so many times.
Imagine.
Yeah.
How'd you get into Korean cooking?
So I studied Japanese at university. Mm. Whilst I was there, I made lots of very good Korean friends who introduced me to Korean cuisine. I knew of Korean food beforehand, but just as a result of living in Japan where Korean ingredients are far, far more readily available, I started kind of experimenting with them. I went to Korea for a month, spent a month just basically relaxing in Seoul, which is very, very fortunate and very lucky, and I fell in love with the food. I thought it was absolutely incredible, so that when I came back to the UK, I continued cooking it. And as I said, I have a very good Korean friend in London who does a lot of street food cooking as well. I worked with him to kind of develop recipes based on traditional Korean methods, but in a way that's more familiar to kind of like a Western palate. Very much Korean-inspired recipes, but with a kind of Western twist to them.
Cool.
Mm.
So how do you introduce the Western twist?
So the Western twist is basically in the form of a burger. I mean, in Korea, you don't get Korean burgers. You get Western burgers, so essentially just like the beef, the cheese, the gherkins, the kind of lettuce. The way that I wanted to do it was to bring Korean flavours in a more easily kind of, not digestible, but just like an easier-to-eat kind of format. So the burger for me is like a Western aspect of it. I mix things like mayonnaise, for example, with Korean traditional sauces, so like the gochujang, which is a spicy chili paste. I mix it up with mayonnaise. Again, something they don't tend to do there. It might even be considered sacrilegious to kind of like interfere with kind of like a traditional ingredient in that way, but through that, then of course the Western garnishes of red onion, of lettuce. The bread is also kind of very Western as well. Over there you get kind of like quite stock standard burger buns, whereas I use a brioche bun. So essentially just like a mishmash of Korean and Western cuisine, mostly Korean though.
How long have you been doing this then?
I suppose the whole planning thing started about 5-6 weeks ago. So 6 weeks ago I entered a Korean cooking competition organised by the Korean Cultural Centre in London. So it was their inaugural competition, they're planning to run it every year. Basically the Korean Cultural Centre in London, its sole job is to promote Korean culture, of which food is a huge aspect. I mean, Korea is a massive, massive food culture. Food is hugely, hugely important over there. It's still almost very ceremonial the way that you eat, and you get lots of small dishes. So they're trying to promote the Korean brand, the Korean image when it comes to food. So I heard about this competition, I entered, it was all an absolute disaster, just because I'd mistakenly not put down some of the ingredients I needed. A lot of them were kind of missing or slightly incorrect, but it was a great competition. I came runner-up as well, which was fantastic. That was really nice. And as a result of that, when I heard that there was a free street food slot available here in Cambridge, I thought, well, why not? Why not just start a Korean burger street food store?
Do you just have one burger or...?
So I have three burgers. Mm-hmm. One pork, one beef. The other one is pork and beef plus pork. The Gogi Gooey burger, which is a beef patty marinated in a bulgogi marinade, which is a sweet soy sauce based marinade. Pork patty, which is marinated in a spicy chili paste. And the pork belly, which is marinated in soju, which is Korea's national alcoholic drink, lemon and mint. All those together with kimchi, the fermented cabbage, the staple of Korean food, cheese, red onion, lettuce and seaweed, all in a brioche bun. And a spicy chili mayonnaise as well, sorry. So
sounds amazing.
I think, yeah.
Which one's your favourite?
I think that one, of the two?
Yeah.
Probably say the pork. You know, I love beef burgers. I love having just very simple, straight, plain beef burgers. I mean, Steak and Honor opposite me do a fantastic job with their burgers. It's absolutely incredible. So I think the pork one, just because, you know, I'd say pork burgers are a lot rarer, a bit more difficult to find than beef burgers. And I think the spiciness combined with the sweetness of the brioche bun works really well for me. So very nice.
Do you make your own kimchi?
No, not yet. The plan is to do one day. The thing about kimchi is you can make it kind of overnight. But I don't want to do that. If I do it, I want to go the full hog and get one of those like massive earthenware pots and stick out in the garden when it's really hot. So no, I don't. I mean, fortunately, we've got Seoul Plaza, the Korean supermarket on Mill Road in Cambridge. So they get their food stuff directly from Korea Foods. We import some directly, so it's a very kind of seamless import route basically to get my Korean ingredients here. And the kimchi that they stock is really, really tasty. It's really good.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Do you have a background in cooking?
Oh. No, not really. No. So, I mean, I've always been a really, really keen amateur cook. I've enjoyed cooking for a long time. I've worked in restaurants and cafes in the past, but mostly kind of like on the shop front as a waiter, occasionally kind of helping out in the kitchen. But no, not really. I can't say I've ever undertaken any kind of training. I've never done any courses, anything like that. Just a very keen cooker who wants to spread a love of Korean food, I suppose.
Nice.
Just to give Korean food a chance. I mean, at first, especially because of like the names that a lot of the core ingredients have, I think people might be a bit taken aback. They might be a bit wary of some of the things. So the pickled cabbage, for example, the spicy chili paste that I use, the gochujang. Try Korean food. It's really fantastic. But I really think that Korean food is going to take off in the next couple of years. It already has in London. London, there's a huge, huge Korean scene, Korean food scene. And I think Cambridge will be the same.
Great. Well, thank you so much for chatting.
Thank you very much for having me. It's very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Thank you.
So there we are. Give Korean food a chance. And I totally agree. You can try for yourself at their pop-up on the 28th at the Free Press Pub or at Food Park, which is in Station Road, Cambridge, on Thursdays and Fridays from 7 a.m. until 3 p.m. They're there on Thursdays.
Yeah, I was there yesterday, actually, at lunchtime, and it really is becoming popular. It's really taking off Food Park, and so it should as well. It's very well done. But I was wondering what else is being enjoyed as far as snacks are concerned in Cambridge this summer. What sort of things have you been nibbling on?
Berries, meringues, lots of ice cream, plenty of ice cream.
Right, sounds rather good.
Yep.
Let's find out what others are enjoying, shall we?
What kind of summer snacks have you been having this summer?
Ice cream.
What kind of ice cream?
My favourite is, what was it, salt? It's like salt caramel. It's just salt. I had it in Albra.
Nice.
And it was amazing. Like, it was very salty. Sorry, ice cream, but it was good.
Good joke.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't know. We eat loads of chocolate, but I guess we do that all year round. So not just in the summer. But and frozen yogurt from over there. So
nice.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
But that's it. Thank you.
Thanks.
We've just had lots of strawberries.
Yeah,
we just had strawberies. Yeah.
Nice.
Strawberry rejects they were.
Yeah, Redux strawberries.
Why were
they're
reject?
Very cheap. They're just, it's not, they don't look so good.
Yeah. But do they taste good?
Very tasty. Yeah.
That's nice. What matters.
It's good.
I'm trying to think what it is.
Oh, no.
We've just had a tea with a yogurt top nut bar, which was very nice.
Yeah. What flavour ice cream have people been ordering?
I think one of our best flavours is lemon,
and
pistachio, and chocolate.
Yeah.
all through your pocket?
This is going to be really unhelpful. We've been eating normal, everything we eat.
Yeah.
Regularly.
Yeah. No, we don't have a specific summer diet at all.
No.
So.
What's your favorite ice cream flavor?
Just plain chocolate.
Yeah, mint choc chip.
Funny enough, lots of ice cream and some berries. But also, a lot of people there who eat the same thing they do all year. Perhaps this is a product of our supermarket culture, when we can get almost anything at any time of the year.
Yes, maybe. Right, thinking back to that cocktail that Aoife produced before, I think an antidote is needed. So here she is.
Aoife, is there any way of using fruit, overripe fruit? You know, this is a sort of a season for fruit ripening, really, before you get round to eating it. Is there any way of using that in a cocktail?
Absolutely. I'm sure plenty of people would want to make jam or bake cakes with it, but I like to think I could put it into a cocktail as well, of course. And actually, this is a nice cocktail because it kind of balances out the debauchery of our previous cocktail, I think. One thing that I did get recently in the market was a load of very overripe flat peaches, and I know loads of people will love flat peaches.
They are very, very flavoursome, aren't they?
They're such a taste of summer, I think. Yeah, they're so beautiful.
Yeah.
One of the last really truly seasonal type fruits that, you know, we really see, I think. You don't really see them at any other time of the year. I certainly don't.
Yeah.
So I got these, and, well, I had some in a salad and, you know, ate some straight away. I had so many, I had to do something with them. So I literally just cut them off the stones, popped them in my food processor, and blitz them down. And then I pass them through a sieve, but not a very fine sieve, because I actually wanted to keep some of the pieces of skin, and you can still see the colour in there. Yeah, a little bit of texture, and the kind of flecks of pink colour from that. And while they're lovely and sweet, they needed something to pep them up a little bit, so I decided to add a little bit of lime zest. So probably, I'd say there's about three peaches in what I've done here, the zest of a lime and the juice as well, just to give that nice kind of zingy summer feeling. And although they were really sweet, I actually added a little bit of agave nectar as well, just to sweeten it up again and balance out the lime a little bit.
Mm.
But it's definitely one of those things you'd want to taste, I think, and see how you go.
Mm.
It's hard to give a difficult recipe when you're dealing with really fresh and especially very ripe fruit.
Mm.
So it's definitely something you want to taste. And I thought that actually just that basin itself, once I tasted it, I had to stop myself just eating it straight away because it was really, really good, would make a nice base for a healthy type cocktail. I mean, you could just have it as a smoothie as it is. But thinking cocktail-wise, had to give it a go. So what I thought that would be really quite nice with it is some elderflower gin that I have. And obviously the season for elderflowers is well past, but people may have made some, you know, in the last couple of months, or have some hanging around the house. I mean, you could also use vodka or rum, I think, would be really good here as well.
Right.
So all I was going to do was pour some of this peach puree mixture into a big glass. It's probably a good 100 millilitres, I'd say, these there. And then we can add some elderflower gin.
And is elderflower gin easily available?
Yes, and actually, this is something that's really easily available. Mm. So not necessarily this particular brand that I have here, but I know there's a couple of brands available in Cambridge Wine Merchants, places like that. And again, you can easily get it online.
Mm.
Or you can make it yourself, which I highly recommend.
Yep.
I'm just going to give this a stir and kind of lets down the puree a bit nicely so that, you know, we can actually drink it a little bit more easily. Ooh, yes. You'll get to taste in a minute. So, actually, the elderflower, it's not too strong and it's going nicely with the peach and the lime flavours. Let's just add some ice. And I think what might be nice here is some wedges of peach and lime. Just.
Well, it certainly looks healthy.
So, we could just be drinking some kind of smoothie here, couldn't we?
Yeah.
I think this is okay, have a go and tell me what you think of my health drink.
There is a nice sourness to it as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
do you think that would work as
a... I think I'm willing to try being healthy. Right, let's just summarise that as well. So you use three flat peaches.
About three flat peaches. I mean, use what you've got.
Yeah.
About a lime. A lime's worth of zest and a lime's worth of juice.
Mm.
Taste then. See how you feel about it. Mm. About a tablespoon, I'd say, of agave nectar. A scant tablespoon, not a big one.
Mm.
Blitz that all together through a wide sieve, I suppose. You want some texture. And then about 30 mils or so of gin. Or, you know, no gin if you want to go completely healthy. Or vodka, rum, whatever you like, really.
Mm.
That isn't particularly strong, I would say. Now, you know, we'd probably end up with a relatively weak drink. So you could add more alcohol if you wanted to.
Yeah. Or drink lots of them.
Or drink lots of them, absolutely.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
And that was Aoife Maxwell, and the peaches came from Chris's market stall. That's the one opposite, more or less opposite Gap. And you know, if you get to know market stall holders, sometimes at the end of Saturday they'll give you things rather cheaper, and sometimes they'll just give them away.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Now, a little news about the next edition. We won't be here in 2 weeks' time because of the Cambridge Film Festival. Bums on Seats will be having an extra show to deal with that, so we'll be back on the 20th of September.
And on that programme, we'll have a feature on restaurant noise and how it can harm or enhance your pleasure of eating out. We'd be interested in hearing your experiences of this. Have you had a meal out spoiled because it's all a bit too noisy or maybe a bit too silent? Or maybe you can tell us about places you've eaten where the sound is at just the right level.
Yes, do let us know. You can contact us by email, flavour@cambridge105.fm.
We've also got a feature coming up on supper clubs. Do you go to them or do you avoid them? We'd be interested in your feelings about them. Again, email us, flavour@cambridge105.fm.
Also coming up on Flavour soon will be a new feature by Tom Lewis, the Cambridge wine blogger. He'll be talking about great wine regions of the world, and each month we'll recommend two or three wines from them. That will begin on the 4th of October. But last year, Tom did a series for us on wine and music, how you can describe wines through music. Here is the second extract we've played this summer. It begins with Tom telling Alan which grape he's going to talk about.
Shiraz.
And that's also known as Syrah.
It's the same grape. Yes, Syrah is the old world name for it. Shiraz is what it's called in the new world. And that's why I've said Shiraz, because what I have in mind here is specifically those big new world Shirazes. Again, you probably had quite a few of them in the 90s. They have lots of ripe, plummy fruit and some sweet spice, maybe a bit of eucalyptus and pepperiness.
Yeah, a lot going on.
Definitely. The key to Shiraz is a sort of more is more approach. It's all about getting as much out of the grapes as possible.
So this is one of the wines that you'd describe as a crowd pleaser.
Exactly. It's lots of ripe, sweet, easy drinking fruit. That is crowd pleasing ground zero, crowd pleasing central. You know, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's fun and easy to enjoy, but we're not talking about elegance or restraint here.
So what would the music be then?
Well, for me, something that's sort of fun and populist, but not too serious. I think of that as Queen, and if it's Queen, it has to be Bohemian Rhapsody.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a poor boy. I need no sympathy. Because I'm easy come, easy go. Little high, little low. Any way the wind blows doesn't really burn.
That was Bohemian Rhapsody. I mean, again, can there be anybody out there who doesn't know that song? But, why is it Shiraz? It's big and complex, but, it has classical root. It is a class act, even if it doesn't try to be too serious.
What about sparkling Shiraz?
Well, sparkling Shiraz, I mean, how much more sort of fun and out there can you get? It's only Australia really does sparkling Shiraz, and it's this is Hugo Weaving in a dress miming to ABBA in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. That's your sparkling Aussie Shiraz. So, Dancing Queen, I mean, for me, the thing with ABBA is they have never been cool, but everybody loves them. You know, they're fun and they made music to enjoy. It's not something to think about or analyse. It comes back to your point, Alan, about it being crowd-pleasing. You know, and yet, actually, the songwriting is very sophisticated. You know, the tunes may be obvious, but they're actually quite difficult to sing. I won't attempt it, but you know, they're not easy songs to sing. And ABBA had a lot of variety in their style, and the arrangements and production are sophisticated. So, you know, maybe you're a little bit superior about ABBA and playing it on the radio, but you know, it is sophisticated.
It's playing Queen that bothers me, actually, but never mind.
Okay, closet ABBA fan. Good to hear it. You and me both. But, you know, ABBA, it is sophisticated stuff, despite its popular image, and it just has this perception of being simple and fun.
But your next red, I should say, has a bit of a darker side, doesn't it?
We're going over to the dark side now, and we're looking at a Greek grape that's called Xenomavro.
Right, now, that's not one I've come across. I mean, I have drunk Greek wine, so I've never come across
Xenomavro. No. I mean, I had it, it's a red wine grape from Greece. I mean, it was described to me by a Greek master of wine as a surly sourpuss of a grape. It's all about the tannins and the acidity.
Well, I can't wait to hear the musical analogy for this one. But anyway, so it's a challenging grape, then?
I think, yes. Again, if we make that distinction between crowd-pleasing and challenging, this falls down on the more challenging side, and therefore, for a wine geek like me, that's what makes it more interesting. So what is Xenomavro like? I mean, the fruit is sort of sharp cherry flavours, and those can be red, black cherry, but there'll always be a bit of sour cherry in there. And then the fruit is sort of red bell peppers and red tea.
So it couldn't be more different from the ripe fruit bowl that is Aussie Shiraz.
Absolutely. There's no Hugo Weaving here. There's no drag queens. This to me is a really focused, energetic grape, and it's one that's quite hard work to live with. It's not sort of there's no softness, no sort of come hither, and no fleshiness on it. But as I say, if like me, you're a bit of a wine geek and you like that sort of thing, it's beautiful, but in a dark and rather feisty sort of way.
Right. So what's the analogy for this one, then?
Well, for Xenomavro, the analogy has to be that the punk poetess of the 1970s, it's Patti Smith.
Yes, well, that really is sort of quite dark and feisty,
isn't it? Dark and feisty,
yeah,
absolutely,
yeah,
yes.
It works brilliantly.
And I think, you know, the analogy even extends to Patti herself. You know, she, as well as her music, she herself is quite, you know, take a look at the cover to that album. You know, she's dark, she's exotic, she's feisty, she's full of energy and intensity.
Yes, yeah, good. And that was Tom Lewis, the Cambridge wine blogger. And as we said at the beginning, Tom will be starting a new series on wine in October.
On to Cambridge's food and drink news now. Steak and Honour are at the Cambridge Film Festival on the Grantchester Meadows tonight.
There's a beer festival this weekend at the Green Man in Thriplow.
There's a gin festival at the Hot Bind this weekend too, and also a cider festival at the Cambridge Blue.
A reminder that the Curly Kale Cafe is at Urban Larder in Mill Road on the 4th of September. Two sittings, one at 7 p.m. and the other at 9, but you will need to book because it will be popular. Contact Urban Larder.
On the 12th of September, Noel Young Wines of Trumpington have a tasting of wines from the Polenta Vineyard in Argentina. Led by the owner, it costs £12.50. Details are on the Noel Young website.
There's a beginner's wine course on the 13th of September at Cambridge Wine Merchants. It lasts from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. and costs £135. And that includes all study materials, tasting samples, tuition and an exam, multiple choice, which you take on the day, and a certificate for when you pass.
Good news from Hot Numbers. As we revealed in February, they will be opening up a new branch in Trumpington Street, in the building previously occupied by Martin's Coffee House. This has now been confirmed and will be opening in 3 months' time. Also opening soon is Bread and Meat in Bennett Street. That's in the old Bennett's Cafe.
We mentioned recently that Dojo's, the noodle bar previously in Mill Lane, will be opening in a new location. The most recent news we've had from them is that it's definitely going to happen, but they're not able to say precisely when. They're working hard on getting the building sorted out.
Looking rather a long way ahead, the dates for the next year's Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival have been announced. It will take place from the 9th to the 24th of May. The website is up and running if you want to run a fringe event or if you want to volunteer to help.
And that's all we have time for today. You can listen to a repeat of the programme tomorrow at 7 a.m. and it will be podcast next week. And remember, you can keep in touch with Cambridge Food and Drink News by following Flavour on Twitter at Flavour105. Previous editions of the programme are available on iTunes and on our podcast page, which is on the Cambridge 105 website.
Coming up next is Life and Arts, Cambridge 105's new arts programme introduced by Daniel Pitt. At 2, it's In Your Company, and 2:30, The Science Show, and at 3, another new programme of Hispanic Voices.
So thanks to all of our interviewees today. Our next edition is in 4 weeks' time on Saturday, the 20th of September. Until then, it's goodbye from us at Flavour.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.